Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
Boston's such an amazing place when it comes to education, when it comes to innovation.
How do we create the vision for every downtown to deal with the fact that downtowns are going to be different? The goal here is to make sure we make them better.
One of the things that we set out to do was to revitalize the Port of Boston and keep it competitive.
Boston's business community is prepared to take its seat at that table of creating solutions and not sit back and wait for the future to unfold.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortslave, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
And Monday sneaks up on you again, doesn't it? Monday, August the 8th. But we've got 93 degrees in downtown Boston on this August the 8th. Welcome to the 2 o'clock hour of Bloomberg Bay State Business. We're with you till 5 o'clock tonight. Equity markets, as we come on the air, they are in the green. The Dow is up some, well, call it 90 points or 0.3%. NASDAQ is up just fractionally, maybe 4 points. Nonetheless, in this 2 o'clock hour, John Chesto of the Boston Globe is going to join us to talk about how things have changed for developers in Boston since Michelle Wu became mayor. The headline in the Globe, Boston mayors have had an open door policy with real estate developers, not Michelle Wu. So John Chesto will be along to talk about that. Also, a local company, iRobot, has been purchased by Amazon. The Bedford-based company that created Roomba has been sold. Also, we've been hearing a lot about this, news about JetBlue. Yeah, JetBlue has now launched a Boston to London service, and travel editor of the Boston Globe, Chris Muther, well, of course he was one of the first people on one of these.
Somebody had to do it, Joe.
We'll be talking to Chris Muther at 2:45. Tom Maroney, he has the week off this week, and Kim Kerrigan is in the co-host chair.
Well, Tom has the week off because somebody had to do that too, right?
Somebody had to do it. He sent out some sort of Twitter thing, over and out, I'm off the grid. I'm like, you know, you got to rub it in, right, Tom? You know, you can't go quietly in
right,
the sunset.
Right, exactly.
No.
All right, Joe, coming up in our 3 o'clock hour, you know, it's a big win for the Biden administration. Initially pitched as Build Back Better, Democrats scaled back legislation in recent months and rebranded it as the Inflation Reduction Act. And now it has passed the Senate and the House is headed back for an emergency session this week. It is expected to pass there. What's that mean for our economy? And what does this mean for the Biden administration? We're going to be joined by Chris Condon at 3:30 to talk about that. On our 4 o'clock hour, we've actually got two stories about cannabis. You know, all of this on the heels of the fact that up on Beacon Hill, they passed cannabis reform. And that means that, number one, we can begin to have cannabis cafes in the state. What is a cannabis cafe? What can you do at a cannabis cafe?
Yeah.
And when will one be popping up on the corner down the street from your house? We're going to be talking about that in our 4 o'clock hour. We're also going to be talking about a new product out, cannabis-infused ice cream.
Gotta have that, right?
Cup of coffee chip and chocolate sunny days, which apparently when you have this, every day is a sunny day.
Yeah.
So that also coming up in our 4 o'clock hour. And Ann, speaking of sunny days,
Speaking of sunny days, Kim, absolutely. It is hot out there. And every day last week, we kept reporting that the mayor of Boston was extending the heat emergency. Well, she's doing it again. It happened through the weekend and again now through Tuesday. The city has these 16 cooling centers for anyone who doesn't have AC in their house. They say that the EMS calls are way up. They've had more than 51 heat-related incidents over the weekend, and just general call volume is up overall. So keep in mind there are lots of options, whether you live in the city or in the suburbs, to stay cool for local pools and beaches. And that really brings us to our local meteorologist, Rob Carolyn, who we wanted to check in with. For just a general forecast, we understand the heat might break around Wednesday.
Oh, it will, and it will. It's currently 72 in Portland and 69 in Augusta. So the cool air is headed our way. It's going to take its time getting here. Right now, we're sitting at 95 at Logan. It's 91 in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Worcester at 90, 94 in Providence. So it's hot. Dew points are also up around 70 degrees, so that makes it feel even worse. And that's why not only do we have the heat emergency in Boston through Tuesday, we also have a heat advisory in effect from the National Weather Service through 8 p.m. Tuesday evening. But after that, a big change in the pattern. Much cooler air is going to come down from Canada. It's going to hang around for a couple of days, and it's actually going to hopefully give us a little bit of beneficial rain Wednesday and Wednesday night in the short term.
Wow, and everybody's going to be complaining, right?
Yeah,
it's August.
When it's only 70 to 75 Wednesday afternoon. Yeah, Joe, they'll start to complain. What the heck happened? And we'll just say Tom took vacation this week. That's what happened.
There you go. He could have, the man deserves it, Kim.
So, Rob, how does this summer and this drought compare, you know, historically to summers in the past? I mean, I feel like this is one of the hottest I can remember.
Well, it's actually been a very unique summer because the first half of the summer was cooler than normal. June was below normal. We really didn't get the heat to kick in until the second half of July. But July, a very dry month, and that's what's helped allow the heat to build. It's been very dry across much of the central and eastern part of the country, particularly the Northeast. Dry soil warms faster than wet soil. So what we've been doing is we're not evaporating any moisture out of the ground. We're just heating things up. And that heat in the central United States, where it's been very dry, has been able to spread here into the Northeast. July, this past July, was the fourth driest on record in Boston, third driest on record in Providence. We only had 62 hundredths of an inch of precipitation, puts us about 4 inches below normal. And it's been below normal precipitation-wise since the spring. What we're going to need to kind of break out of this long-term is going to be like a decaying tropical weather system that gives us a steady soaking rain for 2 or 3 days. Nothing like that on the horizon right now. It's been very quiet in the tropics. Just now starting to heat up in the far eastern Atlantic. There's a wave off the coast of Africa that we're going to be keeping an eye on. But elsewhere in the tropics, it's dead.
But in the meantime, the next 24 hours for our Boston area listeners?
Well, it's going to be hot and humid, Joe. We're up around 95. We're going to watch for some scattered showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. There's some activity right now out towards Hartford and then out towards Keene, New Hampshire. It'll just be hitting this stuff. Tomorrow, as that frontal boundary heads our way, a much better chance for showers and thunderstorms like we saw yesterday afternoon. Some of them could have very heavy rain and gusty winds, and then much cooler, cloudy on Wednesday with some scattered showers throughout the day.
Mm-hmm. All right. Meteorologist Rob Carroll, and thanks so very much for joining us. You know, you guys, I was gone for a couple of days. I was out visiting family in the Midwest, and it was just beastly hot.
Yeah.
I forget because, you know, I haven't lived there for so long. You walk out of the airport and it's like you run right straight into a wall. It's just so humid. But I thought it would be so much better when I got home last night, and that was not necessarily the case.
No, especially with those storms.
Yeah.
My son was in the Pan Mass Challenge, and they finish in P-Town. And I went up to P-Town yesterday to see the finish of the race. And I kept waiting for the temperature to go down. When we got to P-Town yesterday afternoon, it was 92 degrees.
In P-Town. Yeah.
I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm in the middle of the ocean.
Right, exactly. So it's been a hot summer for everybody everywhere. And I will say this, interestingly enough, the Midwest has had a lot more rain than we've had here on the East Coast. So we have to keep our fingers, not just those big downpours, but we need, like he said, a few days of soaking rain.
Some big business news coming out of Massport, Logan Airport, and recent weeks, as we learned that JetBlue would be starting a Boston to London flights, a regular service. The first flight was last Thursday. And, of course, who got a seat on that? Well, that would be Chris Muther. He's a travel editor and writer with the Boston Globe, a regular contributor here on Bloomberg Bay State Business. And the headline on the Globe is, I just flew the inaugural JetBlue Boston to London flight. Here's what it's like. So, Chris, we do want to hear about your personal experience, but if you could, just tell our listeners a little bit about this service. How often is it, and maybe, you know, a little bit about cost?
Yeah, of course. So I had actually been waiting for this for about 3 years. They made the announcement in 2019, and it was supposed to have launched last year, but because of COVID, not. And it's a daily service to London. Right now, it's London Gatwick, and then next month they'll be doing London Heathrow as well. In terms of cost, they're saying about 500 round trip in economy, and I think it's about 1,500 in mint, which is their version of first class in economy. But those are, you know, like the deal. And then after sort of the introductory rates are over, I think we can expect to see prices go up, but I think they're going to try to keep them under British Air, and Virgin and airlines like that, just so they can try to stay, you know, so they'll stay competitive.
Sure. Now, apparently they have new jets for this, and they're streamlined. Tell us a little bit about your experience.
Yeah, so it's a A321, which is a narrow body. But these were designed for long-range flights. So previously this would be more of a domestic plane, but now since they've been redesigned, they can go into Europe. And so that's sort of the plan right now for JetBlue is that, you know, they started this service to London last year out of JFK. They started it this week out of Logan. And at the event on Thursday, the CEO of JetBlue was hinting that they'll start looking at other airports in Europe in a few months.
Now, Chris, I read in your article here that you flew Mint on the Globe's Nicola, as I understand it. Tell us what Mint is like.
So they've redesigned Mint for this new aircraft. In the U.S., when they introduced Mint a few years ago, the setup has been 2-1-2-1, meaning two passengers next to each other. Person behind them gets sort of like a area of their own, two behind them. And they've redesigned Mint for the A321 in a herringbone pattern, which means you don't have to sit next to anybody, which is really nice. and so as opposed to 16 seats in Mint, there's now 24. And two of those seats are called, they're all, 22 of them are called suites, and two of them are called the studio. And the studio is sort of the traditional lie-flat first-class seat. But along with it, there's like a little area where you could entertain a guest. There's like an extra table where that can come out if you want to separate your work area from your snoozing area on a flight. And I decided that since this was a new product that they were rolling out, that I needed to try the Mint Studio. So that's what I did.
Of course you did.
in this opulent, crazy amount of space. But I only wish that my flight had been longer so I could have actually enjoyed
right,
it.
Right, right. And let's talk about JetBlue's, you know, their track record here and what's been going on and how I'm assuming this first flight was right on time.
It was. Can you imagine the stories that would have come out of it?
No, I cannot.
Or if luggage had been lost, any of those
right,
things.
Right, right. So,
their service, as you know, early on in the spring and well into the spring, was pretty abysmal. And part of that was pandemic short staffing. Part of it was just a string of terrible weather up and down the East Coast, which, you know, created this brew of terrible for JetBlue. And so they ended up cutting back the number of flights they offered daily. And then I think the weather has been, at least along the East Coast, slightly better than it was during the spring. So they've been able to, you know, maintain, because before their delay and cancellation percentage was through the roof. And, you know, at the same time, one of the problems is that their customer service, from what I heard from a lot of readers, was that they would wait just on the line forever for someone to help them in customer service. Any luck. So I don't know if that part of it has been resolved. I'm sure it's better because there hasn't been as many issues. So I think they're hoping that between, trying to cut back on flights, and as you know, also they recently, or they're in the process of buying Spirit. And when they buy Spirit, they'll have Spirit's fleet of planes and staff, and they'll be able to really fortify what they have now.
Mm-hmm. Christopher Muther is our guest, Boston Globe travel writer and editor. I'm curious about this particular route and how competitive a space it is and how important it is to JetBlue. You know, because I always think of JetBlue as the plane you hop on to go to Fort Lauderdale, but, mm-hmm. you know, here you're talking about Boston to London and this particular type of seating called Mint. I mean, how important is this to, JetBlue and their bottom line as they move forward?
So there's a couple of things about this route which are interesting. One is that, remember, it's a pre-pandemic plan. And at the time, London was the most requested route out of Logan by JetBlue customers. And the plan of expanding the Mint section from 16 to 24 seats is that a lot of travelers are, you know, back in the day were on business expense. So a lot, like an airline really needs to have a proper business section in order to get that market. But as you know, business travel has not fully come back yet. So right now they're depending on leisure travel. So it will be interesting to see what happens with this. But in terms of the route itself, it is an important route, I think, for JetBlue. And it's also, I get the sense that the CEO, Robin Hayes, who is British, sort of has grander plans for the airline and really to kind of challenge the major airlines in the U.S., not that JetBlue isn't, but now that JetBlue has purchased Spirit, it will put them at number five in the top airline in the U.S. So,
Chris, you're not having trouble getting home, are you?
Well, I mean, I'm in Liverpool right now, so it's 70 degrees here, so I kind of want to stay here.
Don't rush. Don't rush. Personal finance website WalletHub today released its report on its 2022 best and worst states to have a baby. So why are we telling you about this? Because Massachusetts is the best state in the country to have a baby.
There you have it.
There you have it. Let's bring in WalletHub analyst Jill Gonzalez, who worked on this survey of all 50 states in the District of Columbia. And so, Jill, why is Massachusetts number one? What are we doing right here?
Yeah, it's a lot that is going right there. We looked at 32 different measures of cost and healthcare accessibility, things like baby and family friendliness. So really everything from the actual charges, you know, hospital, conventional delivery charges, to how much child care and infant care costs, to how many pediatricians there are per capita. So across the board, Massachusetts ranks pretty well.
And so, Jill, which category do we rank the best? Can you break it down for us a bit?
Yeah, when it comes to healthcare and really looking at that in the scope of having a baby. So very low infant and maternal mortality rates in Massachusetts right now, not a lot of preterm births. We're not seeing that food security for babies is a big problem there as it is in some other states. A high quality of women's hospitals and things like neonatal facilities. So when it comes to healthcare, it is very hard to beat Massachusetts. Yeah.
Well, it seems like New England in general did pretty well here, Jill. We've got what? We've got Massachusetts. We've got Vermont is number two. New Hampshire is four. Rhode Island, five. Connecticut, six. What happened to, and Vermont's right there. What happened to Maine? Where are they?
Maine ranks 17, so still in the top half.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. All right. So talk to us about the cost side of the page here, because you said a lot of this comes down to that.
Yeah, cost is where Massachusetts did not do as well. It ranks 34th. So it is a little bit more expensive to have a baby there. But there is a sense of, you know, you're getting what you pay for because the quality of healthcare is so high. But even, you know, your hospital, conventional delivery or C-section, those charges are a little bit higher than in other states. The average annual cost of early child care is a lot higher. Same with the average health insurance premium.
And for cities that didn't do so well, and where are they?
They tend to be in the South. So the bottom five here are Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and South Carolina.
Uh-huh. And is that a lack of health care, or is that an expense situation, or both?
Really both, across the board. The cost is not necessarily low, even though the quality tends to be very low. We see a lot more and a lot higher maternal mortality ratios and infant mortality ratios. You know, even for parents themselves, there's not a lot of that's been done in terms of parental leave policy within the last several years, whereas in the Northeast, that's actually come a long way.
Jim and Joe, there's a story in the Globe today that's just an astonishing recollection. Do you remember 40 years ago, Jim Rice, the Red Sox player, saved a little boy's life at Fenway Park?
He got hit by a ball.
It was the fourth inning. Red Sox second baseman Dave Stapleton hit a foul ball over the first base dugout, and it hit a little boy named Jonathan Keene. He was 4 years old, sitting with his dad and his brother. He was immediately bleeding on the side of his forehead, and the family was calling for help. Rice jumped over, grabbed the boy, and brought him to the team doctor. What they called Children's Hospital, rushed him to the hospital, and the doctor said that Rice's quick action really was instrumental in the boy's survival. So the boy talked to Boston.com. He is now he went to college. He's totally fine. He's now the CEO of Customer HD in Raleigh, North Carolina. He has a scar over his left eye and has no memory of the event. But when Rice was always asked about his career, he said the thing that really stood out the most was
that experience,
helping that boy get to the hospital as quickly as possible after the foul ball. So a really wonderful story with some incredible photos.
I was going to say there's a famous photo of him running on the field carrying this little guy.
Sure.
Yeah, it sounded like a really – and obviously the reason we have those big nets up now.
Well, I was going to say that. You know, that's one of the that was not the reason, but certainly it contributed to the bats going into the stands and all that.
Yeah.
But that incident alone, they did finally extend the netting, which was you know, a good thing.
A good thing, for sure.
That's right.
Very interesting, and glad you brought that up so that we can all remember what a great thing that was and how it turned out to be a good thing. So, all right. It's not just hot out there, folks. It is very dry, and we probably don't even have to tell you that. You just look out at your grass. Dangerously dry. Janet Wu joining us with more on this worsening situation. She's been monitoring this drought management task force. They had a meeting this afternoon, and I mean, Janet, you go by the creeks and the rivers and you see just how, I mean, things are really dry.
Yeah, you're talking about the lawn. You can look at your lawn. It's probably going to get even browner and drier. Now, at this point, 3+ hours of discussion at this task force on the dire situation. Right now, more than 95% of the state is in some form of drought, and all residents now are being urged to conserve water. A little while ago on the show, we heard from meteorologist Rob Carolyn on the conditions and outlook.
This past July was the fourth driest on record in Boston, third driest on record in Providence. We only had 62 hundredths of an inch of precipitation, puts us about 4 inches below normal, and it's been below normal precipitation-wise since the spring. What we're going to need to kind of break out of this long-term is going to be like a decaying tropical weather system that gives us a steady soaking rain for 2 or 3 days. Nothing like that on the horizon right now. It's been very quiet in the tropics. Just now starting to heat up in the far eastern Atlantic. There's a wave off the coast of Africa that we're going to be keeping an eye on. But elsewhere in the tropics, it's dead.
You know it's bad when you most hope a hurricane or tropical storm comes our way. But as you just heard from Rob, unlikely at this point. And we do have developing news from the task force meeting. Most of the Cape has now been moved from a level 1, which is more mild, to a level 2 drought condition. The Drought Management Task Force, which is still meeting, is going area by area to assess the drought severity. The meeting drew more than 80 representatives from water, environmental, energy, and natural resources agencies and groups, each presenter giving a report more sobering than the next. Here's Vicki Zolte of the Department of Conservation and Recreation.
July 10th onward, even more severe conditions, and some thunderstorms come through and give some brief relief, but you can see that basically since July, been consistently high. Almost 50% of the streams are less than 10 percentile. So that's an impressive amount of gauges at that low level.
Rainfall has been sparse as temperatures have soared with back-to-back heat waves, the latest of which is on right now. Jason Pullender of the U.S. Geological Survey spoke about the water flow in the state's major rivers.
Current conditions, which for the most part gotten worse. Starting with Nashua River, you know, things continue to drop out, still trending down. Going to Charles River, not much help with rain or any thunderstorms. This area seems to just have missed everything. Taunton River, same kind of deal there. Not very good. 11th percentile for the month of July. Got the Neponset here, same kind of trend, dipping down pretty low. Ipswich River, Ipswich, it's looking pretty ugly as well. Kind of sums up some of the most severe affected rivers here throughout the state, historically, statistically related.
Here's Ron Harwood of the National Weather Service.
We can see that just about all areas across the Commonwealth have seen intensifying drought conditions and degrading river and stream flows. And as of yesterday, you know, everyone's trending down, but probably Worcester, Essex, and Bristol counties are looking particularly poor right now.
The drought is affecting what is grown in Massachusetts. Here's Michael Botello of the Mass Department of Agricultural Resources.
All farms are reporting that just maintaining their irrigation systems, whether they're overhead or on drip, is becoming a full-time job with significant cost impacts to their seasonal production. Crops are starting to wilt. A lot of farms are reporting that based on the significant heat and then obviously lack of rainfall. There is some serious concern with the impacts to third and fourth plantings. Folks are also concerned in the southeast corner of the state, southeast region, so Cape Cod, Plymouth counties, Bristol, particularly for the cranberry crops. As we approach harvest, there's significant water usage in that industry, and there is some concern if the current conditions persist, how they'll be able to manage when it comes to harvest.
The areas in Massachusetts suffering severe drought have more than doubled in the past 2 weeks. Vandana Rao from the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs chaired the meeting. A municipal call is set for this Wednesday to offer resources to individual communities and towns.
We are hosting a call with municipal officials where through MEMA's network, all cities and towns have been invited to that call where we will be providing the latest information on what the drought is, what the impacts are, and where they may be able to find appropriate resources.
Right now, the hope is for rain, but Rao emphasizes that it would take several major rain events to change the current situation. This task force is now meeting every 2 weeks, and there could be official orders to conserve water, more of them. 35 water districts have imposed restrictions in the past month. Another problem, almost half of the homes in the state are now at risk of brush and wildfires. And, you know, that's just a whole nother problem. Kim,
well, you know, when you think about the economic impact of this drought, you know, immediately you go to the growing season, which you were addressing there, and that's an issue. But fire is certainly a big problem at this stage of the game.
Yeah, and it's also very costly. And when you think about the resources that were there, and what's scary is we couldn't really show them to you, but we've certainly seen them in the media. But they went river by river and showed images of them. And we've seen what the Charles River looks like. You can walk across it in areas that you would normally have to boat across. So things are dire. As they were saying, they're hoping the weather's going to change, but that's not something we can really count on. So I think people need to brace possibly for more restrictions.
Yeah. Well, Rob Carroll, earlier in the program when he was on, he did say that this pattern is going to change later this week. He said, I don't see a lot of rain. He goes, but the weather pattern itself is going to change. But given what you were just saying about, I think you said 30 to 35 communities have water restrictions in place. I heard somebody speaking about the drought. I believe it was on the radio as I was driving. And he just said, well, forget your lawn. You know, there's no point. No, there's no point in even trying to water your lawn, he said, because, well, A, you've got restrictions in these communities. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, he says, it won't work. So give it up, because you're just going to have to watch the brown grass blow.
Right. Well, people are already starting to make changes. So down in the Cape, I don't know if you've noticed, but normally when you've had those flowing green lawns, people are starting to put in the kind of plantings you see out west, which are drought resistant. I've also known some people that have added some patches of AstroTurf. Mm. So you can have something green. It just may not be real, but you can have green.
Yeah. I just keep going back to I know none of us wants to lose our lawn or our flowers or whatever, but I just keep going back to the impact on farmers. And, you know, we heard him saying just the impact on the cranberry crop now. You know, I mean, these people live, that's how they live. You know, this is their living. And there's not a lot when you get past some irrigation, which, like they said, is becoming the full-time job, and they're running out of even that. There's not much more that they can do. And to lose a crop is a pretty tough deal.
We're going to change gears here. We're going to talk a little bit about new cannabis reform legislation that passed in the final hours of the session that ended in July. We wanted to bring in BBJ reporter Cassie McGrath. She's with the Boston Business Journal. And headline on her story in the BBJ is, what is social consumption of cannabis and when will it start in Massachusetts? Cassie, thanks for joining us. I wonder if you could, you know, as you point out in your story here in the BBJ, The pot legislation passed in 2016. 6 years later, these cafes, they still don't exist. But it really came down to a quirk in the way the law was written. Maybe you could explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, of course. Hi, Kim. Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, so as you said, social consumption, which basically means consuming cannabis on the premises where it was purchased, like basically going to a bar and instead of grabbing a drink, you grab a blunt or something, was legalized alongside recreational marijuana sales, part of the ballot question in 2016. So basically, the law required cities and towns to opt into social consumption, and it was written to say that at least 10% of voters had to sign this petition supporting social consumption. It's a bit complicated, but this would trigger a vote that would occur during the biennial state election. And the law said that the petitions had to conform to these provisions that don't exist, at basically initiative petitions at the municipal level. So there's no way for people to bring these petitions that would trigger the vote. But on Monday, the legislation cleared this up and now basically ensured that there's proper procedures to bring petitions. Municipalities can also approve social consumption by passing a bylaw or an ordinance in their community.
And that's effective immediately, correct? But there are some yes. steps before communities can actually take that vote.
Exactly, yeah. So it's going to take some time. Now that sort of snafu has been resolved, social consumption is going back to the Cannabis Control Commission, which is the group that regulates adult use and medical cannabis in Massachusetts. And right now they're going to review the regulations that they set back in 2019, which is this pilot program for social consumption, basically putting it in about 12 municipalities to test things out, see how things are going. But at this point, you know, that's what's set, but they're going to go and review it to decide, you know, is that still the best way to proceed? And they can make some changes to the regulation depending on what they've learned in the past 3 years. You know, some time has passed since those are set. The commission looks different now. So we'll see what they decide to do. It's going to take, they're going to consult with people from around the industry to make sure they're taking the best step forward here.
Talking with Cassie McGrath, reporter with the Boston Business Journal. All right, let's talk about these cafes. What do they look like? Now, as I understand it, obviously they can't have alcohol served here. But yet I've heard them described as a bar-like setting. Walk us through this.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, it is kind of like a bar-like setting. As I said, it's kind of like instead of going up and ordering a beer, you could get a joint, you could get an edible. There's all different types of products you can purchase, a vape. You know, we're still kind of seeing how it's going to be rolled out, but it could be different ways, you know, or if there's food served as well and things like that. One thing that is part of the regulation is that no tobacco will be sold in the same establishment, so it'll just be marijuana.
And will there be restrictions about how long you can be there, or will you be able to consume it right there, or will you have to go into a separate area? Do you know anything like that?
You know, I haven't seen anything on that just yet. I think that might be something that the commission goes back and reviews. I do know that one of the concerns is kind of standardizing serving sizes for edible cannabis products. You know, there's still a lot of learning around cannabis, and people are learning how to safely consume, what kind of THC levels work for them, and making sure that people consume safely will certainly be front of mind. That also, you know, includes studying in this pilot program if they decide to proceed with it, impaired driving, underage access, things like that, to make sure that, you know, the products are being consumed safely.
Sure. And Cassie, there are some communities you said that are going to be part of the pilot program. What did you say? Did you say 15 or 20? What did you say? 12? What did you say?
It'll be 12, you know, and that's kind of the next step as well. So if they decide to go forward with this pilot program, they would then put it out to a few. There's a few municipalities that they had already kind of worked with. I know Amherst is one, North Adams, Springfield. So they will have kind of a first shot at entering this pilot program if the commission decides to proceed with it. But it'll kind of go back into the municipalities kind of just study it, if that makes sense.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
Lesson number one.
News flash, Big Slim.
I used to be number one in this town.
I'm Joey Tribbiani, and here are today's top stories.
And the number one story in the Bloomberg Terminal in the past hour is actually a headline about Olivia Newton-John. A pop singer and Grease star dies at the age of 73. The story is On the Terminal, it's from the New York Times. She began her career as an innocent purveyor of middle-of-the-road pop, but later adopted a bad girl persona. Olivia Newton-John, who sang some of the biggest hits in the 1970s and 80s while recasting her image, is that of the girl next door into a spandex-clad vixen, a transformation reflected in miniature by her starring role in Grease, one of the most popular movie musicals of its era, died on Monday at her ranch in Southern California. She was 73 years old. And that's the number one story in the past hour on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Kim. All right, Joe, thank you. Well, we want to continue our conversation about cannabis. If you love ice cream, you may want to try this new tasty treat with a twist. Iconic Boston ice cream maker Emac and Bolio, they have a new cannabis-infused ice cream. It's the result of a partnership with multi-state cannabis operator Marybad. And joining us is their chief revenue officer, Ryan Crandall. It's great to have you with us, Ryan. So how do you guys anticipate the product line of ice cream, which is infused with cannabis, is going to affect your bottom line, maybe as compared to other edibles?
Appreciate the question. You know, we are in earnings season, so I can't talk too much about revenue projections or forecasts. But what I can say is that we're incredibly excited about getting Emac and Bolio's and Betty's Eddie's, which is our cannabis fruit chew brand, to collaborate and to create, you know, literally one of the best ice creams that I've ever had, never mind cannabis ice cream. So we're very excited about the possibilities. We're launching here in Massachusetts, and we have plans to bring it to multiple other states early next year.
Mm. All right. Tell us about the two flavors here and how you decided upon them. Give us an idea of what exactly we're buying here.
Sure. So we started off with two vegan flavors. So, you know, Betty's Eddie's fruit chews are a vegan fruit chew. You know, when I met with Bob Rook, who's the founder at Emac, you know, he has one of the best vegan ice cream, you know, recipes out there today. So, you know, we felt like it was the right thing to start with vegan. And coffee chip is the first flavor. It's one of Emac's most popular flavors. And so we've manipulated that recipe a little bit to take into account cannabis. And then a chocolate sun butter, which is a unique recipe. Having little kids myself, I realized that, you know, folks have, you know, serious peanut allergies. So the intention was a chocolate peanut butter, but to make that more applicable for today's world, you know, we swapped out peanut butter for sun butter to make it safer allergenically for people. So we've got a chocolate sun butter and a coffee chip, both vegan, coming out of the gate.
Ryan Crandall is our guest. He is the chief revenue officer at MaryMed. So how will this be sold? Will this be sold just like any other edible in a dispensary, or talk to us about that?
Sure, yeah. So it's a little more complicated than your traditional edible in a dispensary. You know, we certainly have to make sure that the quality of the product throughout from the time it's made to the time that it gets to a dispensary, and then ultimately to the time when a consumer gets it home, that it obviously stays frozen and stays of the highest quality. So, you know, freezers in dispensaries, you know, exit bags to leave the dispensary that are, you know, holding in the cold. So freezer bags to leave the dispensary. You know, we've really kind of worked out all the kinks with regard to making sure that the ice cream, when it gets home, is exactly the way we want consumers to experience it. So there is a little bit additional, right, in terms of things that we have to do to plan every step of the way, but certainly not, you know, rocket science. You know, we've got it pretty nailed down, and we feel like the consumers are getting a great experience.
Tell us about the market research behind this business decision. What do you expect in terms of demand? Who's your customer? I mean, what's the demographic here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty wide. So specifically in New England, I mean, New Englanders are very, very have a high affinity towards ice cream. So, you know, the data that Bob Rook from EMAC has shared with me is that, you know, the largest consumer base of ice cream consumers in North America are actually in New England. And it's funny enough that their consumption actually goes up higher during the fall and winter months. So it's a little counterintuitive. But the demographic for this ice cream is really, you know, everybody who consumes ice cream that also wants to consume cannabis. And so, you know, women make a lot of decisions in the household, but, you know, I know plenty of men, as I'm sure you do, that will go in and buy a pint of Ben & Jerry's or Haagen-Dazs in their grocery store. So, you know, the reality is we know that people a lot of times use ice cream as a relaxation tool as they're sitting down to watch a movie. and similar to cannabis, right? So, you know, cannabis, from a need state perspective, people are looking for cannabis to relax. So we view it as a perfect pairing for consumers that are either looking not to have a drink at night, you know, or looking to have a delicious ice cream, but also to, to have cannabis effects as well.
And Ryan, talk about the THC and how much, you know, how it's going to be served, because, you know, will it be a one serving, or, you know, there's recommendations about gummies and how many you would want to take. How do you regulate that?
Sure. So we actually give a serving size on the package, mm-hmm. right? So we're starting off with a 4-ounce cup. So 4 ounces is 1/4 of a pint.
Okay.
And in that 1/4 of a pint, there are 20 milligrams of THC. And so there are 4 servings within that quarter pint. One of the things that we see is that a lot of times people, you know, don't want to eat a full, you know, half a pint of ice cream to get 5 milligrams as a single serving. So some of the consumer feedback was they wanted some more milligrams within a smaller serving size. And so that's what we're coming out with, is a 4-ounce, 20 milligram cup, but we will allow consumer feedback to direct us in terms of where we go from here.
And where will this be available? Will this be available, say, at some of these local pot shops, or where will it be sold?
So today it is sold at our dispensary location in Middleborough, Massachusetts, which is Panacea Wellness. And very shortly, I would say by the end of the month, we will start shipping to a select number of retailers across the state of Massachusetts.
So they're going to have these big refrigerators when you walk in now, and you'll be able to pick out your ice cream as well? Is that?
You won't be able to pick it out yourself. It'll actually sit in the vault in the back, and they'll bring those out as they get ordered. There'll be all kinds of in-store promotional materials to indicate there is ice cream present. And in certain locations, we'll be doing non-infused samples of what the ice cream tastes like. But, you know, the freezer resides under lock and key in the vault with the rest of the inventory.
And Ryan, will there ultimately be more flavors? I mean, will you be able to get just any kind of EMAC and Bolio ice cream infused?
So not everyone. So to answer your question directly, I've got 2 more flavors that are coming. So we've got a brownies and cream that is a dairy flavor that'll be out in about a week. And then we've got a black raspberry that's coming that's absolutely delicious. So we're going to start with 4 flavors. We do have a plan to add additional flavors, but we want to make sure that people are loving what we come out with. And then EMAC, you know, one of the things that they're teaching us about ice cream is, you know, keep it fresh. You always want to kind of have something new hitting the menu and identifying, you know, which of the flavors is least favorite and potentially swapping that out as we go. But we figured 2 on the vegan side, 2 on the dairy side, get consumer feedback around how they like the flavors, and then go from there.
All right. He's Ryan Crandall, and he's the Chief Revenue Officer there with MerriMed. We do appreciate you taking time and joining us on a Bloomberg Bay State Business. It's time to, talk about tomorrow here. We're back here, of course, at 2 p.m. on Bloomberg Bay State Business. One thing we're going to do is we're going to talk with Joe Piantedosi. He is the owner of a bakery, a co-owner of a bakery there in Malden. They have some 200 employees, and guess how these 200 employees all get to work? Well, not all of them, but guess how a majority of them? Well, they take the Orange Line. Mm. And the Orange Line is now going to be shut down for, a month. So we'll talk with you'll hear our conversation with Joe Piantedosi tomorrow on our program starting at 2 p.m. We're also going to talk about a new survey out there that talks about the population on Nantucket this summer. It was up, get this, 69%, while the workforce was down some 13%. We'll dissect some of those details tomorrow. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business. We're back here tomorrow at 2 p.m.